I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Adam Green. He is a cognitive neuroscientist and Provost Distinguished Associate Professor at Georgetown University, where he directs the Lab for Relational Cognition. He's also the editor-in-chief of the Creativity Research Journal and an expert in the neuroscience of creativity, which we're going to be talking about today. Adam, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you, Adam. Good to join you.
So you were just telling me before we started recording about some interesting work looking at natural language processing approaches to studying creativity.
Yeah, right. Well, the work I was bringing up is something that's actually really new in the lab that we call Shape of Thought. And so we have a couple of directions that we're going with this sort of broader project of Shape of Thought. But the basic idea is that, you know, over the last maybe 25 years, some terrific work has been done to map out semantic spaces. So essentially taking massive aggregations of text corpora, books, magazines, you know, movie subtitles, all kinds of things in largely in English, although these are now being developed in other languages as well. Mm-hmm. And looking at different ways that you can essentially assign words and even senses of words, locations relative to each other in this extremely high dimensional space. Mm-hmm. And basically what that allows you to do is, one of the ways that's been leveraged that, you know, my lab has used that kind of work and many others is to look at the distances between words in these spaces as in our case as a proxy, a quantitative proxy for creativity, essentially to say how far apart are the concepts that you're putting together with your creative idea as a sense of as an index of how creative the idea actually is. But the shape of thought variable takes that really to kind of another level, because essentially, instead of just looking at semantic distances in the space, what we're interested in doing is looking at as people generate concepts, and there are a few paradigms in which people serially generate concepts, things like the alternate uses of objects task, which is a common classical creativity measure. Like you get a brick as a prompt and you say all the things uh-huh. you can use. A brick for, you know, a less creative thing would be a doorstop, and a more creative thing would be to grind it up and use it in your Halloween costume as fairy dust, you know, those wow. kinds of things. So, but then there are even sort of somewhat simpler paradigms like something called forward flow, where you simply start with a prompt word and then generate a word that's an associate of that, and then an associate mm-hmm. of the next word, and so forth, or just simple verbal fluency tasks, which have been around for many decades as a measure of cognitive flexibility. In any case, these paradigms in which you serially generate ideas allow us to look at the ways that people progress through semantic space, their journey that they take from whatever shared starting point we give them. So if I give everybody the prompt word horse, you know, and then see where you go from that. What we're interested in doing is looking at a number of the sort of spatial features of your journey. So is it a circular journey? Are you going back and forth between the same, or is it a linear journey? Are you sort of traveling outward in semantic space to more and more distant places? Are you going back and forth, say, between if I start with horses, are you going between, you know, horses and snacks? So you might say graham cracker first, right? And that's a big leap, except now you say cow, and then you go back and you say bagel. And really I realize, well, you're just doing a little trick here. It's not all that creative. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we're starting to see is that people are differing in the shapes of their thought, the shape of their thought trajectory. And we're fascinated by the idea that people, that these shapes of thoughts might be related to other variables, other creativity variables, even other personality variables, and other questions like how two people's shapes of thought might be indicators of how well or how poorly they would work together, or how much they might like each other or dislike each other. Do I like people who sort of think through concept space the same way that I do, or do I actually need somebody whose shape of thought is complementary to mine, as opposed to more similar? So those are some of the questions that we're looking at. And yes, it is. So to your original question, we're applying machine learning to language, but in this sense, it's actually applying machine learning to shapes, to the geometry of thought, as opposed to the just the semantics.
Yeah, and it's not just pure variance, right? Because there are ways that you could give wild answers that, at least in the sense of being non-predictable, they're creative. But then there's, do you think there's like a right and wrong form of creativity? Because, you know, if you mention horses and then you're asking people to come up with things, you know, if you say unicorn, or maybe you think unicorn, and then you start listing off magical creatures, and that's sort of creative. If you say something completely unrelated, like sawdust, then there's just as much variability there, but it seems like people wouldn't call it creative so much as just like weird.
Yeah, this is a long-standing debate in creativity, in the science of creativity. So one of the things that I'm happy to be part of is the Society for the Neuroscience of Creativity, which has really grown a lot. And this is really just in the last 6 or 8 years. And currently I'm the outgoing president. I'm only president of this organization for another couple of months, but it's been fascinating to see what the creativity community is sort of focused on. And there's so much that's new. There's so many methods that are new, and especially on the neuroscience side. But some of these questions, like the one that you're raising, remain very much debated. And the notion of, to what extent do we want to apply the standard of task relatedness or usefulness or meaningfulness, depending on who you ask, to divergence in order to characterize whether or not a product, and by product it could be a word, is creative. And I think that that's an interesting debate. But I actually, I'm actually more enthusiastic about moving the debate somewhat away from putting labels on creative products and sort of, because it becomes fairly subjective in a way that's hard for an empiricist. and moving more toward process, right? Focusing less on creativity as products, and focusing more on creativity as process, which ultimately I think has a lot more potential to inform ways of supporting creativity, right? I think, firstly, that's intrinsically what the science of certainly the cognitive science or the neuroscience of creativity is focusing on, is how creativity happens, not the product, but the process. Uh-huh. And if we focus on process, you know, that takes us much closer to educational practice, right? You don't teach a product, you teach a process. It takes us closer to brain-based enhancement, right? Which my lab has done some of and is invested in doing a lot more of. You know, how do we intervene at the neural level to support creativity? We're not intervening in a product, we're intervening in a process. We have to understand that process in order to be able to effectively support it and enhance it. And so that's something that I've pushed as president of SFNC, and that I think, I think more and more researchers are starting to move away from that product-based definition, which I think helps take us away from, it doesn't answer the question that you're asking, but I think, I'm not sure how productive that debate ultimately is, because if you think it's creative and I don't, you know, and we're both talking about the same product, I'm not sure how much it matters which one of us is more right.
Right. So as a process, from an evolutionary perspective, would you call creativity like a high risk, high reward strategy? Because you could imagine if you're doing what everyone else is doing, then you're probably like as likely to survive and get the resources you need as everyone else. And then if you go off in a completely different direction, maybe you'll be hyper successful and discover something new, or maybe you'll just die.
Yeah, it's it's a good question. It's another one that has certainly received some thought in you know, in the history of the science of creativity. I tend to think that that's a reasonable narrative. I think certainly, you know, there may be a simpler narrative evolutionarily that focuses more on adaptation, you know, not in an evolutionary sense, but evolutionary genetic adaptations that allow us to adapt, you know, within a lifetime, within a moment. So it's not all of creativity, and probably not most of creativity, has to be particularly risky, but it allows for newer or better ways of solving a problem. And I think that has certainly been an evolutionary advantage, and almost certainly been selected for.
Mm-hmm. So I know that in intelligence research, there have been some debates about whether intelligence is like a generalized thing like IQ, or if there are multiple intelligences across different domains. I'm wondering if with creativity, it tends to be more generalizable, or if people can be creative in one domain but not others.
Yeah, you're hitting on some of the great classical themes and debates in the science of creativity. What you tend to see is not too dissimilar to what you see in the intelligence literature, which is that the answer ends up being some of both, that there's some generality, but also quite a bit of modularity, especially if you're looking at, you know, and here it starts to matter a lot, like which activities one wants to consider creative or creativity. And that's not always a simple question. So for example, there are people who are tremendously gifted violinists. And I bring that example up because I have a particular person in mind, a particular case study in mind, who actually are not, don't show other generative creative attributes, right? So do we want to say that, well, a person who's a good violinist is necessarily creative? I think that depends a lot on how much we weight the sort of generative versus technical elements of performative art, right? So I bring that up, which is a bit of a weedy kind of example, but only to say that the more general the measure, the more it seems to relate to other measures, and the more sort of specific and sort of hyper granular the measure of creativity, the less it seems to, you know, track with other measures. But by and large, the picture looks like, yes, there are general creative traits and creative abilities, but also modularity, as you see on the intelligence mm-hmm. side.
Yeah, that generativity point seems very important, because you could imagine if someone is playing like a fancy Mozart piece, then they're certainly highly skilled, but Mozart is probably the creative one. They're kind of just copying. So you could imagine that, I mean, it's an oversimplification, but a computer could do that in one sense if it knew how to like produce the right notes. But then if you would need something more like artificial intelligence to genuinely create new music, and especially new music that sounded good.
I think that's really right. And I actually, that generative part is to me kind of the heart of what makes for creativity, what makes for real creativity. Mm-hmm. Again, that generative part, I think can be conceptualized in terms of process, not in terms of product. I think the goal of generating, that if you're operating essentially, you know, so I'm working on a paper right now with James Kaufman and Roger Beatty, who are a couple of terrific people in the creativity world. And essentially what we're putting together is sort of a process definition of creativity that really does focus on generativity, but also focuses on alignment with neural data. And so essentially the argument that we're making is that creativity is, we're calling it the deployment of internally directed attention under the constraint of a generative goal. So essentially it has to come from within, and it has to be a process that's operating in with some constraint. It can't be just sort of meaningless pathological divergence like you might see in schizophrenia, but that goal has to be generative.
I guess neuroscience must come in terms of looking at internal generativity, because you could imagine if you're measuring something that's like a real output, like art or something, then maybe more creative people are generating more, but maybe they're also just more industrious. But then if people are thinking more creative ideas, but they're low in industrious, maybe they have no output, even though they're like, in a technical sense, more creative. And then there's probably everything in between. So you have to disentangle those two.
That's exactly right. And I think I skipped over the actual example that you brought up, which sort of raises the, at least a somewhat opposed, point on the overall shape of things, which is that you can have people who do produce music, for example, and might be quite industrious, right? But to your point, those people vary quite a bit in the extent to which they actually are technicians versus generators. And in fact, some of the research that we've done has been specifically looking at what we call the paradox of the uncreative artist. So in particular, looking at a construct that Rich Dacre in my lab has really led the way in developing, which is creativity-specific anxiety, or creativity anxiety, or cranxiety, we like to call it. And what this is basically, it very much in parallel with math anxiety, an anxiety that really does seem, over and above general anxiety and other forms of anxiety, really does seem to be specific to coming up with new ideas, with generating new stuff. And so what we've been sort of surprised to find is that in many cases, people whose job is to be an artist actually are very high in creativity anxiety. So in this case, the violinist, actually, who I mentioned, this is the father of someone in the lab who is a professional violinist, actually in a very sort of well-known symphony, but who considers himself to be entirely uncreative and is not at all interested, and is in fact made sort of anxious by the prospect of coming up with a new idea, a variation on a musical piece, for example. Some musicians, when they play, they're interpreting, they're generating, right? It's not just sort of reading out what Mozart did. It's making it their own in a lot of really really meaningful ways. But others are much more technically gifted and are amazingly proficient without being generative.
Mm-hmm. Where did you come from in like the creativity sense that got you interested in pursuing this research? Are you a highly creative person, so you wanted to understand it, or was it more like it's so interesting to see different types of creativity, and then you want to understand how it works from an outside perspective?
It is so hard to answer questions like that. And I don't know if anyone is really ever very good at answering the questions. You know, there's a long history in psychology of why it is that we actually choose the things we choose. And most of it
could just be like innate personality preferences, and who knows why.
Yeah, much of it suggests that we actually, whatever answers we give to those questions are just stories we're telling ourselves. But I've always really enjoyed the endeavor to be creative. I have always been a writer. My sister's a much better writer. She's a well-known poet. I've always very much just enjoyed the aspect of science that is generative. Come up with a new set of stimuli, come up with a new paradigm, come up with a way to test something that no one else has, been able to quite get at. I think that that's so much of the love of science that I have. And so I think that, it certainly revs my motor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Creating those stories also seems to be a creative endeavor. As you know, I recently went through the grad school application process, and you have to describe in your personal statement a bunch of activities that in reality are probably quite independent, but then looking back, you kind of have to weave a narrative. And it seems to be like the more creative you are, the more you can sell that narrative.
I think that's quite right. Yeah. Hey, I don't know what's on the agenda for us to talk about, but when you were visiting here, we had the beginnings of a very interesting conversation on free will. I'm happy to keep talking about creativity, but you know, I bring that up because I think that would be fun. But I also bring that up because one of the things that's true about my interests, you know, as an academic, is that they aren't actually limited to creativity. That there are quite a few things that I think, And actually, that's something that I think we observe a lot in creativity, is that people who are, you know, who enjoy being creative are interested in more than one thing.
Right. If you were interested in only creativity, that would be a bit of a paradox. Yeah, I'd love to talk about free will. I'd also love to talk about some of your more recent studies on belief, including religious belief. And I don't know if those are related in any way. But maybe we could introduce the work you've been doing and then try and tie it into free will.
Yeah, sure. Let's go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So take it away. You know way more about the neuroimaging studies.
On the religion stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a lot of fun. So it's been a fascinating sort of last few years, actually, with respect to those studies. We did a project in the US and Afghanistan, and actually also collected some European data, but we were actually collecting data in Kabul. And sadly, I don't think, you know, we didn't know that at the time. It was already a somewhat scary, actually, proposition to be doing that at the time we were doing it. Of course, we didn't know that that may not be possible again for quite some time. But a student who was a PhD student who was at Georgetown and is also has his Master's of Divinity and is a fascinating guy. He also happens to be the world record holder for fastest marathon run while juggling. You know, just toss that in there. We have
a whole marathon while PhD juggling.
What'd you say?
The whole marathon while juggling without breaking.
It's called joggling, I've learned. Yeah, right. Every inch of the 26 and is it 26 miles? 26 and
yeah. I can't even imagine juggling for as long as it would take to do that marathon.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Well, and if you drop, I think they're tennis balls. I'm not sure. I don't think it's like bowling pins. That subtracts from your time because you have to stop and pick up the tennis ball and go chase it down the street or whatever, you know? So in any case, fascinating collaborator. He was among the other things that he does, is Zach Warren is his name. He was the head of data collection or research. It's got a title for the Asia Foundation. And so he puts together the study of the Afghan people for the Asia Foundation. And in any case, in talking to him and a couple of other collaborators, we realized we had the means to do a study that was ultimately funded by the John Templeton Foundation, where we looked at this really, really curious little question that we had that had come out of some pilot data in the lab about people who are better at learning patterns unconsciously. So implicit learning of patterns. And there are a few paradigms that you can give people to, you know, the little dots appear on the screen and they press buttons for when they see a dot in a certain position. What they don't realize is that as the pattern continues, if it is indeed a pattern, they start like pressing the button before the dot even shows up on the screen. They don't realize that they have implicitly learned the pattern. And then of course, when there's not really a pattern, they're not able to do it as well. But they can't consciously tell the difference. In any case, this notion of picking up on these hidden patterns, you know, we had this hypothesis that it would be related to detection of patterns in the broader world, right? Many of which are not many of which are hidden, many of which are, you know, there are regularities that we're picking up on, but that we aren't consciously aware of, that those might then influence our intuitions about the orderedness of the world and the orderedness of the universe broadly. And if that was the case, then having intuitions that there was an ordered world and an ordered universe might bias people more toward narratives that describe some entity that orders the universe or orders the world. And so essentially, whether at least some of what might explain the sort of universal presence of this belief in ordering entities, these deities, and what might explain the variability in this belief within different cultures might be related to the sort of universal presence of implicit learning and the variability in implicit learning as an individual difference, which it is a substantial and stable individual difference largely throughout the lifespan. So we looked at that, and it turned out that yes, that the people in both the US and Afghanistan who were stronger at implicit learning in these goofy little lab tasks that we had, also were stronger in belief in a God that orders the world, and that actually they showed a trajectory just based on self-report, whereby the better you were at implicit learning, the more you increased from childhood to adulthood in your belief in an ordering entity, independent of actually of how religious your parents are. So that was another. So if you were born in a relatively non-religious household, you would tend to become more religious if you're seeing patterns, is the way we're understanding it. And if you were born in a relatively more religious household, you would become, overall the trend was people would become less religious if they weren't implicitly picking up on these patterns.
Right. It's interesting the way you lay that out, the belief in an ordered universe, because that seems to be a pervasive belief even in scientists, non-religious scientists, especially yeah. physicists, because it's like, you know, seeking out the grand equation that can describe everything.
Sure. Well, we looked at that too, actually. We looked at whether this would be related to a measure of belief in science, essentially. And it was not. It did not track with that variable. So it tracked with the religious sort of order, but not the the scientific kind of order. And I don't know that we have that we fully have our heads around why that might be, but I think it might point to differences in the extent to which belief in science versus belief in supernatural things are based on intuition, because the argument that we've made and that's come out of some longstanding literature is that implicit learning shapes intuition. It doesn't shape. It doesn't directly shape sort of conscious, decisions about how much do I like science or how much do I like religion. So that if belief in religion is more intuitively based, then that might be consistent with what we think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So within religious people, you also looked at in the neuroimaging scanner what happens in their brain when they think of God and think of these other religious ideas. Is that right?
It's a project we're working on right now. We're really interested in using this method that I'm sure you're familiar with, called representational similarity analysis, where what we can do is look at the patterns in the brain when people are representing different entities. So in this case, they might be representing God, but they might also be representing various other real or fictional entities, like a parent or a historical figure or Superman. And what we're interested in doing with representational similarity analysis is looking at what is it that people are representing when they're representing God, and asking that question in terms of how much is that representation similar to real things, like real entities like their parent or like a historical figure, versus entities that they know are fictional, like Superman. And the idea there is to both sort of get a handle on what the representation of God is broadly, but to look at that as a difference across different groups of belief groups, mm-hmm. right? So do our believers and non-believers essentially representing the same thing, only believing in that thing to a different extent, or are they representing fundamentally different things along the lines of maybe more real versus more fictional? And those are the kinds of questions that, like, this is ongoing. We're just collecting this study, so we don't know.
Uh-huh. So the idea might be that non-believers could still create the representation, but they would have it similar to like the Superman fictional representations, and then the believers would have it more similar to the way they think of actual real figures.
One thing we know is that non-believers still have a mental representation of God. So that's something that has been shown in a few ways. And some of the early pieces coming out of this work have shown that actually the non-believers and the believers seem to be similar in the extent to which their representations of God are anthropomorphic, at least based on their own kind of self-report measures. So it is definitely the case that non-believers are representing something, and that something seems to share at least some properties with whatever it is that the believers are representing.
So if anyone's going to do it, I could imagine being a creativity researcher is a good fit. But what has it been like trying to bridge this empirical science with these more theological topics?
Adam, I've stopped trying. And you know, you say you have to sort of build these narratives. When I applied to grad school, I did. When I went up for tenure, I did. I've stopped. But there was, it was always a little bit contrived, at least a little bit contrived, right? These mm-hmm. links. And essentially, I've accepted, I think happily, that I'm interested in more than one thing. And I've stopped apologizing for that. Of course, that's one of the great things that tenure will do. It is, it allows you to stop apologizing and stop sort of crafting narratives other than just, yeah, this is what I wanted to do. And this is, you know, something I got excited about.
How has the work been received by both people on like the more philosophical, theological end, and then also more of like the hard science neuroscientists?
Yeah, I mean, I think by and large, that study, you know, in Afghanistan got a fair bit of attention, and I think it, you know, got interpreted in the ways that everybody always interprets anything, which is that, oh, this agrees with what I already think. That was by and large the, you know, so people who on the more religious side, there were a number of things written saying, look, this proves that God is real and that religious people are picking up on the sort of hidden reality of God, whereas, you know, people on the less religious side were saying, well, look, this is just evidence that people are fooling themselves into thinking that God is there because they're picking up on these regularities in the real world. You know, the study itself is agnostic, obviously, to the existence of God. We didn't set out to prove or disprove the existence of God. But that's just probably a broader comment on the nature of media consumption these days than it is anything else.
Yeah. I guess we could try and loop free will into this by talking about, again, the sort of intuitive pattern seeking you mentioned, or pattern recognition. Because it seems like if you're picking up on those sort of outside forces that lead to a certain outcome, you might believe less in your own free will. But then if you don't have that intuitive pattern recognition, maybe you have a falsely inflated sense of your own autonomy.
I think it's an interesting point. Yeah. I mean, so I think the questions related to our belief in our own free will are interesting. And I mean, I think that there's a literature around that, and also around, like, well, is it adaptive both at an individual level and at a societal level for people to believe that we are free to choose our actions and determine our thoughts. But yeah, I mean, I think at the core of, I guess my, the question is, are we, you know, actually, you know, I think there are cases to be made for whether we should or shouldn't, or whether we're better off or worse off believing that we are. But sort of the basic question of whether we are, I think that's the one that revs me up the most. And as that relates to, I know that you have a bit of a background in physics, right? Am I mistaken there?
I wouldn't call it a bit of a background other than it was my first college major and I watch a lot of YouTube videos about like popular science type stuff. But anyways, my first ever podcast was with Jonas Kaplan, a neuroscientist, and he laid out an anti-free will argument saying that when we think we have free will, what is really happening is our brain is essentially making, either using pattern recognition or picking up on predictions. And then as long as the predictions go right, it's like, hey, I caused this. And then only if, he used an example of playing piano. So it's like, he said something like, you're playing faster than you're actually picking up on the notes. So as long as you're playing it successfully, you think that you're causing it. But then if you mess up, you mess up before you realize you mess up, and then you kind of have, your brain has to kind of catch up. And he used that as an argument against free will in the true sense.
So what would that mean in terms of what, why, just to lay out the parameters of the argument. So why is that? And I it's not that I disagree at all, but why is that an argument against free will?
I think the idea was that the brain is essentially running on autopilot, and that what our conscious perceptions are essentially like scanning error correcting machines, so that mm-hmm. when, so long as everything is going according to plan, then we are okay with thinking we caused it. And then, or maybe it was, if we make a mistake, we think we kind of jump in to fix it and then let the autopilot go in again. He described it better than I'm able to recollect.
Well, that's just fine. I think the question I have is a lot more basic, which is that, so in what context then is that juxtaposed with, you know, the possibility of free will? In other words, what would free will look like? Would that be if we actually knew everything that was going on in our own brain? Would that be free if essentially we had the control over our brain that we imagine we do? Would that be free will? Is that, I guess it matters in terms of the parameters of the
yeah argument. And I think one parameter that's often overlooked is identity, because when we're talking about an agent having free will, we're first talking about an agent, and even what that is isn't that obvious. So like there's the classic philosophical problem of the ship of Theseus, and it's like, if you have a ship and you take one of the wooden planks off of it and replace it with a new one, is it the same ship? And most people will say yeah, but then if you do that with every single part of the ship, is it still the same ship? And some people say yes, because it's according to the same layout. Some people say no, because none of the original material is there. And it seems like both answers are equally valid. And it seems like you can do that just with your own identity, because what is it, like every 7 years, all of your cells die and are replaced. So it's like, you're not the same person that you were 7 years ago, but you are. So it seems like free will depends on how you're defining the identity of the agent which has the free will. So it's like, if you trip over your shoelace or something, was that according to your own free will because you made the step onto the shoelace and you caused yourself to fall? Or is the shoelace outside of you and it caused you to fall, so you had no free will over the matter?
Yeah, well, so this is where I think we get into something interesting, because, sorry about that, my phone keeps doing things. This is where I think you have to actually consider, so what would it mean? Are those two alternatives actually different from each other, right? And this sort of inside us versus outside us, right? Because I think one of the really important realizations, I think, that that has kind of shaped the kind of semi-recent debate in understanding how the observer is sort of involved in broad quantum understanding of the universe, is the realization, of course, that we are physical, right? And that we are therefore guided by, or you know, that we are operating based on quantum mechanics. And it's not that our shoelace is fundamentally different from us in that sense, right? And it's also not the case that, you know, and this is something that when I talk about this with students, sometimes they want to move more in the direction of, well, my genes determine, you know, my actions, and that's why I'm not free. And that's essentially what it is that makes for a brain that is not free. But I think all of that really comes down to the more fundamental question of whether any physical system could be considered free, right? So if we don't separate shoelaces from you know, elbows, let's take an example in which genes weren't determinative or reset every 4.2 seconds, your entire genome reset, mm-hmm. Would it actually matter? Would that have any actual bearing on how much we could claim to be free? Because essentially, if what we're saying is that, as I think most neuroscientists would say, that we are a physical system, mm-hmm. right? Then it seems that you have kind of two alternatives, one of which isn't a real alternative. You have the alternative that, okay, it's classical or Newtonian physics, in which case, gosh, there's no way to imagine freedom, I think, because if you know all the preconditions, you can, with enough computing power, you could predict everything that would happen next after those preconditions. Or you have the quantum alternative, the quantum, which we know is, well, as much as we can know things, is actually what's happening. But there you have what? You have wave functions, right? You have essentially randomness. It's difficult for us to think about that as freedom, as the sort of agentic free will that we think all want to have. But the point that I try to make to students with that is that people who despair too quickly of those two alternatives, I think, are giving far too much credit to our understanding of physics and to our understanding of quantum mechanics, our present understanding. If there's one, maybe even in your first year or two of college, if there's one thing that's extremely, extraordinarily evident about quantum mechanics, it's the vast amount of it that is not understood, the phenomena that we can describe but cannot explain, and that is not to say that somehow those phenomena guarantee us or promise us free will. In fact, I think the case for free will is probably really grim at this point, but I think it's probably a bit hubristic to claim that we've somehow ruled out free will because it's physical, right? I think that's the key point. To say that it's all physics, so it can't be free will, that seems just plain wrong. Like there's so much that is unknown. And we could get into some of the, I guess, some of the specific.
Well, one of the most outlandish ideas I've heard, but it also has this nice intuitive appeal to it if you can get behind the craziness, is that, so it's kind of a panpsychist view. So the idea is, from the outside, when you're looking at particles and they're kind of just doing these quantum jumps, it seems completely random to us. But then the what if idea is, what if that's also a form of free will? So it's like, from the particles' perspectives, you really have to be a panpsychist if you're going to believe this. It's making like free decisions, essentially. And then from an outside perspective, it seems random. And, you know, on one hand, it's an untestable theory. But then on the other hand, because it's untestable, it has this interesting what if.
Yeah, I do. I think that's probably fair to call that untestable. And I think that's the kind of thing, those kinds of things tend to be the things that really, turn a physicist red. And I try to, I think it's not to disparage, those kinds of, what ifs, but I think even within the space of what is sort of known and endorsed by mainstream, you know, quantum mechanics. I think there's not necessarily, you know, a need to sort of have recourse to some sort of universal consciousness or you know, or a panpsychist view to point to many phenomena that are simply not understood, that we know are actually the basis of brain function, right? And so to say that we've ruled out the capacity for or the possibility that, you know, there is some affordance for something that we might consider free-ish within those quantum dynamics, I think is giving up the ship a little prematurely. So
it's called the hard problem of consciousness for a reason, I guess.
Well, that's a little bit different, but yes, there's a lot that's hard about
consciousness. Well, I guess that would be a bigger question that we probably don't have time for, but it's like, can free will exist without consciousness, or can consciousness exist without free will? And I'm sure people have made arguments for both claims.
Yeah, I mean, consciousness is such a mucky issue. In you know, I think it's one of these things, and I can, you know, I know we are about at the hour, but you know, I think consciousness is one of these cases where, in the ontology of sort of human cognition, we've decided that, you know, this is a word that we say, and so we expect the brain to somehow deliver it up for us as a real thing that we can find. Right. But we don't expect, you brought up unicorns, right? We can say unicorn, right? And we can imagine what a unicorn would be, but we don't necessarily have the right to expect the universe to deliver that up as a real thing. So I think consciousness is perhaps a bit of a trick that we are, you know, playing on ourselves, depending on what we ask of it. So, I mean, I think there's good cause to think that something like meta perception, you know, of our own, you know, essentially some kind of looped evaluation of our own experience, right? Experience of experience is something that the brain does manifest. You know, whether that checks all the boxes that everyone who's interested in consciousness wants checked, I think is not always clear that it does. But it's also not always clear that those boxes ever really existed.
It was great chatting with you. I hope at some point we record a follow-up and dive deeper into these consciousness and neurophilosophy topics.
Thank you, Adam. And yeah, I know I kind of hijacked us and took us in a few other directions, but I'd be happy to chat more creativity stuff at some point. And this was a lot of fun. So thanks.
Thank you.